This is a Pinball News production.
So, hopefully you're all here to hear about Inside the Melon. So we're going to talk about the electronics that were in the original four Wonelli games. Go ahead. So first I want to give you a little bit of my background. Most people don't know me, and that's on purpose. I like to be behind the scenes, so this is kind of uncomfortable for me. I'm an electrical engineer by training and trade. I have an undergraduate degree from Iowa State University and a master's degree from University of Minnesota, so quite a while ago. I've been an electronic hobbyist basically all my life, so since the 70s I've been blowing things up basically. My programming experience started on a Radio Shack TRS-80, so way back then. So I'm still using 8-bit processors, so haven't went too far. In my career, I do integrated circuit design. We do mid-range processor design for IBM. And I've been in the pinball hobby since about 2006, when I found a machine I looked for a long time, an OXO machine that I remember playing back in the arcade days. So started with that and grew from there. So as I said, this is the original Wonelli. I just want to point out that there was one EM that is kind of how I got started on this. We'll go through a little bit of the background. And then there were three solid-state versions. So really that's where my involvement was, mostly in the solid-state ones. And the Stern Wonelli that was later developed as a completely different system. That's a new spike system. So we were done with Wonelli by then, and this was announced last Expo, so in October of 2014. And then later they announced that was going to be based on the new spike system that they had developed. And I don't have any details on the spike system in here, but that was announced in January. So I've got a whole bunch of stuff I wanted to go through. I want to go through, you know, how this started and what my goals were with this board set. The bus that I use, which is based on the CAN bus. I'll go through the board set that we have and how it worked. A little bit on the software, which is a big part of all of this, is how the software works. There was a prototype that we developed that we dubbed Black Hole Junior, and I'll show you a little bit about that. One of the key parts was, partway through it, we decided that Wonelli needed audio. So there was a separate audio board that was developed. And then later we did a full machine prototype, converted a SolarCity EM to solid state. And then I've got a little bit of details and pictures on some of the Wonelli builds. We had some fun doing that in Dennis's garage. And if you want to hear about it, I have a little bit of where we went after Wonelli, some of the future stuff. So I really would encourage questions if you want to see certain stuff, because I don't think I'm going to get through all of this, so I'll go through some of it pretty quick. And if you want to hear about certain pieces, be sure to ask questions, and I'll tell you anything you want to know. So how this whole board set started, Dennis, I don't even know if we've talked about this, but there were kind of three things that happened all at once. One was I had a Star Trek Next Generation that needed a complete overhaul. So I was tearing that all down, and I realized that it took me about 45 minutes just to get enough wires disconnected to get the head off the thing. So I'm like looking at all these cables going everywhere. For work, I was working on the PS3. We did the cell processor for the PS3 and IBM, part of a Sony Toshiba IBM joint development. And my part in that was related to the I/O buses on that, which were super high-speed buses on those, both for the memory and the interchip connections. And another thing happened at the same time was that there was an interesting article in one of my electronic magazines about the controller area network bus, called the CAN bus. And between those three things, I saw that you really could do something different here. You could take, instead of having large buses of wires going between the major components, you could do it with one high-speed bus. And it doesn't really have to be all that high-speed for a pinball machine. Next. So to back up just a little bit, how I got involved with Wonelli, we had a group that helped with EM pinball problems called Team EM, and Ken Walker's a friend I made through that group, and he had asked me at the time, since I was coming to the Midwest Gaming Classic, if I would help him get the Continental Cafe version of Wonelli up and running so they could play it at the show and just make sure everything stayed running. And as part of that, he was also asking me, since the original Continental Cafe was a three-score reel game, how they could add a 1,000-point score reel to it. And that's kind of my background is electrical engineering, so I kind of like to look through schematics, so I've done, you know, studied what they did through history and all these different machines, what they did differently, how Gottlieb did things versus Williams. So I was pretty familiar with it, and it turned out that one of the Flipper Cowboy games, you know, was a very close match to that, and we could just add the score reel exactly the same way they did. So I sent him a little schematic like this, and he added the 1,000-point score reel in.
Eric, was that before we met you in Milwaukee?
I don't think that was before that. I think we were, you might have only had three score reels in it at the first Milwaukee show. But
I remember you were the guy that told us easily how to change it from a two-player game to a one-player game. I think Ken just changed a couple of wires, and we were amazed.
Yeah, we'll make it sound complicated for you then, okay, Dennis?
What you're talking about, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. But as I went back through my history, I realized we didn't really keep good notes on any of this. It didn't seem all that like
important
it would ever. It wasn't important at the time. Well, and it was routine stuff, right? I mean,
we were just having fun.
Next page. So this is where we got started. This is the first Wonelli that was playing at the Midwest Gaming Classic. It's still on the Whitewood. This is the EM machine there. But it's got the full back glass, so it must have had four score reels at that point, or maybe it had a dummy one in there at that time. But
it was before yesterday, so I don't remember.
Next, Jacob. So this board set I had needed a name for it, and I don't know if I like the name, but I came up with this pin kit name. So it was a pinball, and it was a kit form that you could take these boards and build what you wanted to with them. My whole concept was based on distributed functions, because that's what we were doing in my real job at the time. We were distributing things around. So if you look historically, we had things called CPUs, central processing units, and you did that because the processor was the huge expensive part of your system, and you had to bring everything to that because you couldn't afford to have more than one of those. But it isn't anymore. The processors are cheap. What's really expensive is connecting them all together. So most of what I do in my job is trying to connect these things together. So it makes more sense to distribute the processors out where you need the work done. And I'm not claiming this is new. Gottlieb did this. They had little pop bumper boards they put out there. It's just interesting how this kind of stuff kind of comes and goes. So if I have one thing I claimed I actually did, what I've defined is a common bus and a message set. That does everything you need for pinball. So, and it's not a huge message set. It doesn't take a whole lot. And what it does is it allows you to connect up via board addresses. You can hook up 16 boards into the system, and they all interoperate to, there's a master board, and then they can control things out to the slaves. Next. So what I was trying to accomplish here was make this whole thing more modular. Again, taking the head off of an EM game is actually really trivial. There's a couple plugs, and it got complicated as we got into solid-state games, so I was trying to get back to that, where you'd have basically just a power cable and a communication cable to connect them together. The other thing you gain from that is as pinball volumes go down, these parts start to get more expensive. So the other thing I saw through the PlayStation work was what happens when you have a million of something. It starts to get really affordable. So if you, instead of having one main CPU board in your pinball machine, if you have 10 boards that do that same thing, you have 10 cheaper boards. The volume goes up by 10. They get cost reductions. It's also very easy to have spare parts. So in the system, what you have is you want to take the playfield out and or the back box. You unplug a Cat 5 cable. I use the same cables you use on Ethernet cables, and a 6-pin power cable. So the CAN bus, for those of you that don't know, is used in cars. So everybody here has one. If you have a car that's from mid-80s on, it has a CAN bus in it, and many CAN buses. So it uses something called differential signaling. So instead of having a common ground reference, it sends a pair of wires. It sends a high and a low over that. So it has its own ground, if you would think of it like that. So what this does is it removes any signaling issues between boards. A lot of common fixes out there are, at least on the old Gottliebs, was making ground fixes that hooked all the grounds together to a common point. So now you don't have any of those issues. It can talk over this bus, whatever the reference is on each board. It also has one advantage in that this bus is designed to be robust. You can short it directly to 40 volts forever without causing any problems on the transceivers. Obviously, the bus doesn't work, but it doesn't break the parts. And it can handle transients of, you know, small spikes up to 250 volts. So it's a little bit unfortunate. In Wonelli, we had 27 volts, so we were quite safe. In later games we're using 48 volts, so we got a little bit of a risk there. I really, really wanted this to have fast power on time. I didn't want to have a PC that boots up. It was just one of my personal goals. And if you look at this, it becomes very power efficient, but that's really mostly through the use of LEDs, so I won't focus on that. So to give you a picture of what I did, this happens to be a picture in my space shuttle game, System 9. You can think of any board. They're all basically the same. Some of them have a separate solenoid driver board as all. But so there's lamp drivers, there's switch inputs, there's coil drivers, there's a CPU section. And if you take all that and look at all that function that's all on one board, and go ahead, Jacob. And then you break that apart into four different boards and put a fourth of it on each one. This is all I've done. I've just distributed the function across the little boards. You now have four CPUs and then a fourth of the lamp drivers, switch matrix, and coils are all on there. Okay. Just an aside, one of the titles I thought of this game was, or for this presentation, was How to Make a Small Fortune in Pinball Electronics, because, well, for people that think I'm doing this for anything other than the hobby, here's the secret. Step one, start with a very large fortune. Oops, go back one. Because that also works for farming and banjo playing. Okay. So next section, what I want to talk about is this CAN bus, and we've covered it a little bit, so I'll go through this hopefully quickly, but it's used in cars. It's a two-wire bus, and it's designed to be used in noisy environments, which kind of fits our pinball world. It can go up to a megabit per second, and it has hardware-supported error checking and retry, cyclical redundancy checking on the buses. So you can daisy-chain a bunch of these together. You can get up to 100 nodes on here. I don't get anywhere near that. A message itself is up to 8 bytes. So you can send 8 bytes of data between any two points. And I'm using two of those, so they're variable length messages. And I chose two because it got all the information I needed in there. It doesn't, however, tell you what the physical connection could be, so it's really a two-wire connection, and you've got to figure that part out. I needed two conductors for a differential pair. I looked at all kinds of options. The cheapest thing by far is to use standard Cat 5 cables. You can buy them with ends on them already, cheaper than you can buy parts for anything. So that was my choice, is to use Cat 5. So the message set was defined. Messages are 2 bytes. I have 1 byte of opcode, so it's really 4 bits. There's 16 different types of operations, and then sub selection of that opcode, and then 1 byte of data. And I guess I should point out there's no hardware restriction on this. This was strictly a software choice by me. You could do 3-byte messages without hardly any changes at all. Again, the Cat 5 connections, I'm only using 2 of the 8 conductors in the wires, so I decided I might as well do something with the rest ones. So I sent 5 volts and 12 volts over those. So in some cases, I can run a board without even running power to it. I can just power it over the Cat5 cable. Now, I'm not running the full 1 megabit per second. I'm running 250 kilobits per second. Again, more of an arbitrary choice, but it actually helps by not having too many commands coming at a board at a time. But given that, I can handle over 3,000 messages per second at this 250K rate. So it takes me 316 microseconds to send a message. So it's plenty fast. There's no noticeable latency at all. I've actually wired flippers and run them over the CAN bus, and you could play the game without even knowing that's happening. So the message that I have, and this is all of them, I have a coil or solenoid message. You can send a message to pulse a coil. And part of the command could be how long to pulse the coil. You can also turn the coil on or off. There are switch messages, so when a switch detects a closure, it sends out its own message. It can be, I saw an edge, or I am now, it can be a level-sensitive switch that says I'm now on, and then I turned off. And you can also send out a message from the master, or I guess anybody could send it out, but you can say, what's the current state of this switch? For the lamp commands, I have turn a lamp on, turn a lamp off. Actually, part of the on message is how bright it's going to be. So one of 16 brightness levels. I can tell it to blink. And part of the blink message is how fast you want it to blink. One of, again, 16 different blink speeds. And there's also a flash command that says turn it on and then turn it back off. One of the ways to make this more efficient was to make lamp groups. So you might have, say I might use it for like the match lights, for example. You put all the match lights into one group, and then you can say turn the group off, and then you don't have to care which one's on. They just all respond to the group message. There's score messages. In Wonelli, we had score reels, but we drove them just with the 4 coils. So really, they're sort of coil messages. But by sending out a score message, we could make it more automated. So there's a score that says, you know, add a value to the score. You have to tell it what player it's on so it knows which reels to work, to operate, so you can set the player. And you could also, like a power-up, send a reset command to say, clear everything out back to 0. Sound was added later, but from the sound commands, you can say, play a command, play it once, so it plays basically a WAV file. I'll get into that a little later. You can also say, queue up the command and play it after the current sound stops. You can have it loop or repeat. And you can also control the volume for the different tracks that the audio card can do. There were some control messages, things that everybody needed to know about, like you're starting a new game, you're starting a new ball. A tilt will send out a message to all the boards and say you're now tilted, so the score stop, and game over. And for example, like new ball will then automatically reset any tilt that was in there. There were some heartbeat commands. These were more nervousness on my part originally, but so a board will send out a heartbeat originally to say it, or periodically just to say it's still out there. And the master would watch and see if he ever saw any boards disappear out of the system. Again, I've never had any issues with that. There's also a couple code points that are just user-defined. So if you wanted to make your own message, you could actually extend this command set. So, and I have some details that have all of the encodes I use in all this. Yes, Dave.
The score messages seem to be of a computer-to-computer type message, as opposed to most of the other stuff is actual component to computer or computer to component, you know. Is that an interesting distinction there? Something that you wouldn't have had in an older board system?
Yeah, that's probably true. In this case, I just needed some way to for everybody to agree on what the score was. And in Wonelli, we had 2 boards that were designated as score boards. So they specifically ran the score reels. There was some special code in there to handle the reset and automatically watch. So the reset command would pulse the score reel until it got back to the sense the switch position that it was home, for example. So there, you probably could have done that through normal, you know, just say this is a switch, and then it was a normal coil, but then you would have had the master would have been responsible for doing that. So part of the goal here was to keep the slaves doing as much as they possibly could, so you didn't, you don't have a lot of horsepower here. I'll get into that, and you'll see why I had to offload some of the function. Next. So this is a blown-up picture of the board. Actually, I have one here if you want to pass it around. This is, there's a extra credit if you notice what's different about it, I guess. So this is the board we used in Wonelli, and it had a group of 8 switch inputs. It had a group of 8 lamp drivers in the upper right there, and in the bottom right was a group of 4 coil drivers. So these are basically standard Williams System 9. They've used those in a lot of different games. TIP 102 drivers, very standard. The CPU is there in the middle. That's my, I use PIC microcontrollers. I'll show you some details on that. And then the CAN bus is in the left here, and that's just run. That's just to a pair of RJ45 connectors, and they're actually just dotted together. So it daisy chains through this board. You can plug into either one. The microcontroller I use is a microchip PIC. They do a lot of controllers. They've been in the business for a long time. And the one thing you have to worry about when you're trying to source parts for this stuff is how long the parts are going to be available. And microchip is very good about having parts available for a long time. So I don't know, you can probably go out and look, but they haven't end of life this part yet. It's been around for a long time, and it'll probably be here for at least another 10 years. There's 32 kilobytes, and these are kilobytes now. These are all really small processors. So it holds 16,000 instructions in one of these boards. There's 1536 bytes of RAM or data memory, and it's actually kind of annoying to write in assembler for this thing because the memory's banked. I write everything in C, and it handles the banking for you automatically. It'll run up to 40 megahertz or 10 MIPS, so it's 4 clock cycles per instruction. Now, while this is a pretty much low-end processor, what a microcontroller gives you is some special engines to handle some of this or offload some of the stuff. And one of the things this has in it and why this specific part was chosen is it has a CAN engine in it. So if you want to send something on the CAN bus, you just do a write into the CAN engine, and it handles everything for you, the retry and everything. There's a library provided by Microchip that basically just include in your C file, and it'll give you a send function. So, but the CAN engine does most of the work, so there's not a lot of CPU cycles tied up in sending or receiving messages. There's also a serial engine to handle SPI, serial peripheral interconnect, and I2C, integrated circuit bus. So we'll talk about those a little bit. But again, it's programmable in C, and it has a 6-pin connector that you can buy a cheap programmer for. It's, for $25, you can buy a USB-based programmer for this board. Next. Again, if there's questions, we can handle it as we go along here. But this is my cartoon diagram of how this whole thing works. So basically the green boxes are my boards. So the controller boards get scattered amongst the components. I'll show you some pictures later of how they're situated in Wonelli. So you can put as many of these on the board as you want, stick them under the playfield, you put them in the cabinet to handle the coin door. And the purple buses are the power. So basically from the power supplies, you run out to all the boards, you run out plus 5 and plus 12 volts, and then the coil voltage, whatever that is. In this case, 27 volts. And then the black wires there, daisy chaining through the play field and up into the back box and then into the cabinet, are Cat5 cables. Now, in this case, the master board was up in the back box in this one. But it doesn't really matter. as long as everything's hooked together. You daisy chain it through the end and put a terminator on either end. Okay. So from a board point of view, ideally we would just have had one board, and that's kind of where I started, was a controller board that acted as either a master board that ran the game sequencing code or responded to commands, and those were the slave boards. Later I did an optimized board to do a flipper driver. It's actually this exact same hardware, but I didn't need all of the switch inputs and I didn't need lamp drivers. We were worried that about the latency, if the board was doing something else, whether you'd see the lag in the flipper buttons. And there was also a lot of extra handling in there for the flippers to handle it, like if the end of stroke switch gets stuck open, gets stuck closed, all the weird stuff that can happen to make sure the flipper coils keep working and don't stay on because they burn up pretty easy. We did do a display driver. At one time, we had talked about doing maybe not having score reels in the electronic Bonellis so they can drive up to 7 1-inch digits. Dennis and Greg love lamps. Originally, I was looking at doing this as EM conversions, and if you look at EM, there's really not a lot of lamps on the playfield of an EM. If you look at Wonelli, there are a lot of lights. I'll show a count later. So instead of having to stick a lot of boards in that could only drive 8 lamps each, I built a lamp matrix board that could drive 32, so it just knocked a lot of boards off the... I could use one of these instead of 4 other boards. That was really just a cost reduction. Again, although it drives lamps differently, it's still the same command set, so there's no special commands for that. And then later there was an audio board that did sound playback from an SD card. And I can pass that around too. This is the audio board. Later I did it on a little bit bigger board. So I laid out and designed all these boards through ExpressPCB, and that happens to be a form factor. They'll get you really cheap. You get 3 boards for $80.
Are you going to show this on screen?
I'm not sure I have a picture of that one, actually, but we'll see. Next. So I want to make sure I get through all this, but I just want to hit a couple things on power supplies. The boards operate on 5 volts, 12 volts, and they can handle up to 80 volts on the coil voltage. Actually, the lamps can go up to 24, but we use 27-volt supplies, and we use an ATX 12B 12-volt supply. Really... we couldn't find any way to get it as cheap as you can buy just a computer power supply. It's way overkill, has way more 12 volts and 5 volts than you need, but it works conveniently, and we just built an adapter to run the standard 24-pin connector right off of the supply. One other thing is there's really no restriction. The lamps and coil voltages are per board. You could use different ones if it was useful for you. Next. Just a quick thing here. We had a lot of questions about this while we were going through, while we were demoing the stuff, is how do you do this, how do you do that? One of the questions came up a lot was why we didn't have zero crossing on our coil drivers. So normally if you look at AC, an AC waveform, what we have is usually a full wave bridge rectifier in there that converts it to DC, but it's not really a filtered DC, it's a pulse DC. And a coil pulse is usually 20 to 40 milliseconds, so depending on where you start, you could hit a different point in the waveform. So you can get a significantly different pulse strength out of a coil if you don't know exactly where you're starting. So the Williams board have a zero crossing detector, so they always wait and they start it at the same time. With a regulated supply, this isn't an issue. Next. So if you look at filtered DC, it really just puts a capacitor on there and smooths those bumps out. The other issue is switching versus linear supplies. If you go buy off-the-shelf supplies, they're almost always switching supplies these days. So a linear supply is a nice behavior, I guess, if you will, and that if you draw too much current out of it, just the voltage droops a little bit, but it goes on with its life and keeps working. A switching supply, this isn't inherent in the switching supply itself, but the ones you can buy almost always have overcurrent detection in them. And that overcurrent detection kills you because you need at least 12 amps, or 10 amps, sorry, to keep the coils running. And that was done mostly through trial and error. But if you overcurrent these supplies, they actually shut down until you cycle the power, so there's really no good way to bring them back. So you really don't want to trip the overcurrent. So in Waldenelli, we use this mean well. It's a 350 watt, so a 27 volt, 13 amp supply. And on later games, we're using a 48 volt version of that. So again, they're both in the 13 amp range, and they've worked very reliably for everything we've tried to do. I did a nine ball play field in my game, my home game, and so it has multi-ball, and it was all working. Next. Okay, switching topics here again. A little bit about my software. Again, it's all C software. It's all compiled. There's no interpreted code here. Every coil, lamp, and switch has an 8-bit ID. So that's the second byte of the command usually. And I use the first 4 bytes or 4 bits as the slave ID. So each board has an ID that's programmed into it via DIP switches. And so it recognizes that if it's board 4, when it sends out a switch command, it puts board 4 on it. And the last 4 bits are which switch number it is or which connector position. So if you get a switch ID 41, it's on board 4, switch 1. Scores specified somewhat similar. It's a kind of almost a floating point number, if you're familiar with that. But basically, it's a magnitude and an count. So I send out a 4-bit thing that says which score real it is, and then a 4-bit number to say how many times you want to pulse it, so up to 16 times. So if you think about it, you never really want to pulse it more than 9 times. So it all works out. And so between those two numbers, for example, if you sent out a hex 25, that 2 is 100, 10 to the second power, and then 5 is how many pulses on that reel. Next. So I have some real examples here. So if you want to pulse a coil, there's a command in there. It says send can message 2, so a 2-byte command can message. And the first parameter for that, it says it's a coil message, and it says pulse the coil, and then 22 is the coil number. So in that ID format, that would be board 2, coil 2. And this is all done through defines in C, so they're really just constants. So you could put regular hex numbers in there. There's nothing magic there. It's just easier to manage in the code to have something more readable. For example, to turn on a lamp, you send a message that says message lamp on. And this one turns board 3, lamp 3 on, for example. And then the score is the same way. And just showing here that it doesn't really have to be a constant. You can just send a hex value in there. So that happens to be the add score command. So add 500 to the score. Next. The other thing about the code is the slaves can do a lot of things by themselves. So you can actually configure a switch to control a coil, and you can configure it to send a score message. So if you think about this, the best case is probably the second one, where it's a pop bumper. So you can set up a pop bumper to score 100 points. You can tell it to automatically send a message to fire a coil, and you can tell it, the score and the coil are really the interesting parts. The switch edge, part of what you program in as the type of switch, says how much debounce you want in that switch. So how long, how many milliseconds is it going to wait before you detect it as a true edge? So there was like an edge fast that would say, for a pop bumper, I don't really care. I just want to see it happen, and I'm going to do something right away. And then for more things like the outhole, you would have, say, well, it has to be stable for a long time. The main code that's in each of the board, this is a little crude, but this is the basic flow that it goes through. I don't know how, but probably can't read that very well. But so every millisecond is really the key. So it runs a loop every millisecond. It reads the switches, checks the lamps, checks the coils, and checks these things I call timers. So one of the things you can do in the code is set a timer and say do something after a certain period of time. So since you can do that, one of the things, because a switch edge can cause a coil command, for example, you may actually have a valid command sitting there waiting to go out or be processed at the end after you read the switches. So it's saying, okay, do I already have a command? If I do, then it processes that command. If you don't, then it goes to try to read one from the bus. So it goes to the CAN engine and checks to see if a message has come in. And if that's valid, then it processes it. Otherwise, in the game code, there's a couple states that there's sequences of things that happen. Like in Wonelli, if you hit all four rollovers and got a blit, it would do something. It would change the mode of the game. And then in the master, you'd also have this check game state. If you go forward, then I have a little bit of a sequence of how the game state worked. So the game state, again, if your ID or your board ID said you were the master, it would go through this special sequence, just a finite state machine that would run through. When it starts up, it would go into this reset state, do some basic initialization, and then go into the game over state. That's where it waited at the beginning of time. And then eventually you'd hit a button to start it, or it would go into a tracked mode. If it went into a tracked mode, it would wait for something to happen, pressing the start button, and it would pop back into game over. And then it would handle a new game. It would set up all for a new game. There was a special state that would go through when you're starting a new ball. There was a state for launching the ball. And then eventually got into the play ball state there in the middle, and that's really where it spent all the time in this play ball state. So it was handling all the different messages that would come in, basically anything related to gameplay was in there. And at the end of the ball, then you would go through the collect bonus state and then some end of ball sequencing and then back to a new ball. So it just runs the sequencer over and over. Next. I just wanted to show you one exact example. This is real code out of Wonelli. I won't go through it all thing, but this is a case that was rotating the gobble holes. I had some generic code that I'd written for Solar City that had an alternator in it, so I happened to use that code. So it was rotating this alternator. People that are familiar with the EMs will recognize the alternator relay. So basically it says if you're in alternator state 0, go to alternator state 1, and then turn off the lamp that was associated with 0 and turn on the lamp associated with 1. So it's really bouncing this lamp around every time this function got called. And then at the bottom, I don't know if you can see it or not, but there's this nsched function was a way to schedule a function call for a future time. So that section of code we had that said check timers, that's what this did. It was a timer now that said, you know, it was 16 milliseconds per tick. So in 5 ticks, do this rotator alternator thing. So there was always cases where we wanted to have a little bit of lag before we actually handled the actual rotation. It just worked out nice when you saw it. It seemed like it was working a little differently. Next one. This is another exact example. This is the pop bumper when lit code. So this isn't exactly the way I originally pictured it working, but this is how I ended up doing it. Is that instead of the score messages being fired directly by the pop bumper, the pop bumper just sent out a switch message. Because there were cases where the pop bumper was lit or it wasn't lit and had to score differently. So you either had to send out a mode and say, okay, you're in 1-point mode or 10-point mode, or it came over to the master, and then the master would figure it out. So the sequence flag was just a thing that got set when the light was lit. And so if you were set, or not set at the beginning there is really what it's saying. It would say add 1 point, and because of the way it worked, it actually had to send out the message and then to add the score to itself. So one thing about the CAN bus is it can't talk to itself. It's actually kind of a drawback of the way it works, and in the future code, I've done this a little bit differently where it's handled more automated, where you just queue the message up and let it figure it out later. But here I was actually doing it. If I needed to send it to a board and to myself, I did it manually. And then this was turning off the ball save there. So basically any score thing that happened would reset the ball save flag. So if you got to the bottom of the end of ball and the ball save flag was still set, then it would just not advance the ball count. Question? Yeah.
No doubt you're familiar with the PROC system that came a little later, and then the FAST system that's come more recently. And you may have heard the seminar this afternoon with Python's Pinball Circus where they were talking about evaluating controller systems because they were having problems with reading switches and things. How have you done any kind of comparisons, and how do they all compare to each other as far as latency?
No, I did some exchanges with Jerry Stellenberg when I was originally starting this, so I do know a little bit about PROC. I don't know much about the FAST system. I did have a conversation with them last year at Expo, but I haven't looked into exactly what they're doing there. So I want to quickly go through something. In 2010, when I first started this, we agreed that we do a prototype just to show you that this board system I was had pictured in my head was working, or and what I designed was going to work. So to do that, I wanted to do a prototype playfield. I was trying to figure out how to do that. So and what I needed to show was that my controller board and the flippers worked, and that we could score. So I wanted certain elements on the playfield to be look like a real game, I guess I would say. And, you know, a demo of all the major pinball components. And the cheapest way I could figure out to do that was to actually buy a lower playfield out of a black hole. It's pretty much an entire game in itself. It has pop bumpers and drop targets and switches and a pair of flippers. And so what I did is I flipped that upside down, because in black hole it plays backwards. So I don't even know if anybody noticed when they were playing it that all the wording was upside down on it. But I built a little tiny cabinet for it. The whole intent was to bring that here, take it out back, show Dennis and Greg what it was doing, and we were going to be done. And for some reason, that thing wound up in the vendor hall. And it was just there as a game that everybody was playing. And usually I like to be a little more thorough. If we were going to have it out there, we would have tested it a little bit more, I guess. So I guess we'll call it a success. The kids loved the game because it was shorter. Because even though it had standard legs on it, the cabinet was shorter, so it was a little bit smaller and wasn't as wide. And that game held up amazingly well. I don't think we had any problems at all with it. It didn't have any glass on it, so it got a good test there, and everything worked well. Here's a picture of what it looks like. I put it sideways here to fit on the screen better. The one thing that's missing there is, since you don't have the game, you don't have all the parts that it takes to shoot the ball up, because normally that shoots up to the upper play field. So I dummied it up so it would dump the ball back down up at the top. So that's the launch mechanism, that clear tube on the bottom. Go on, Jacob. And this is the little black back box that was rigged up to hold the score reels. And then at that point, we were still considering the seven-segment displays, so we had those mounted there too. So it was actually a two-player game, and Wonelli, even though it has one set of score reels, is actually a four-player game. So since you have electronics there, you can just reset the score reels back to zero for the next player, so it all works out. Next. And then the one thing we realized on the way home from Expo is that since it only drew 40 watts, it would actually run off the little power inverter I had in my car. So just for a joke here, we fired it up in the car, and that's Jacob here playing the game. So it's our new in-car pinball entertainment system. So the next part I'd like to go through quickly is the audio board. The original idea there was to pick up some cheap 8-bit soundboard or build one and play WAV files. And at the same expo, we had the Black Hole Jr. Chris Graner was nice enough to talk to me, and we had a big discussion about what this needed to do. For reference there, I do have a reference. You should go to his website and see all the games he's been involved with. He's got an amazing list of games. The key points I took away from that is he said, check into this 4-bit adaptive differential pulse cold modulation, which I didn't know anything about at the time. And he was adamant that we needed 3 tracks. So I was kind of heartbroken because I didn't think my board could do 3 tracks of sound. It's a lot of work. Basically what he said is you need background sound that play all the time, and then you need voice and effects that can play over that at any time. So you need a voice call out, and then you might hit a bumper while that's going on, so you might need a sound effect. Next. Let's skip over this, but actually go back just a minute. But the cool thing about this algorithm is that it compresses 16-bit sound into a 4-bit value. So you get 2 sound values per byte, which is really what you need here, because I'm trying to read it off of a micro SD card, so I need to save the bandwidth. Go ahead. The basic board on the left side is exactly the same. It's the same as the other boards that go on, but instead I put a higher power second PIC microcontroller in there to handle the audio, which hooks to a micro SD card, and then it runs through a PCM1755, a digital audio converter. That's the same ones used in the like Star Trek Next Gen. Next. This microcontroller is quite a bit faster. It's 16 bits instead of 8 bits. It has a whopping 64K bytes of instructions, and it has 8 kilobytes of data, which turned out to be just barely enough to make this all work. It also had a serial engine that I could use to do the communication to the other boards. That was nice. And just like the other ones, it's programmable in C. This is just the commands. We'll skip that. So the audio storage, and this is the way we did it in Wonelli. We're still using these audio boards. It stores them in these adaptive differential. I called them AD4 sound files. And we just gave them a name. And the key to that name is the 001. And so if you play sound 1, it goes and finds that sound file by looking up the name in the directory on the SD card. It's a standard FAT16 format, which is, if you're familiar with that, an old format. It can only go to 2 gigabyte cards, but it does compress things a bit and takes up less bandwidth, so that's what I'm using. I formatted in 32 kilobyte clusters because that's the biggest you can get, which minimizes your access. So I can get 35 hours of sound onto this 2 gigabyte card. So for what I wanted to do, that was way more than enough. So the source file is 16-bit mono at 31,250 samples per second. And there's really no reason you can't use larger SD cards. In fact, we're using 8 gigabyte ones now because it's actually hard to find 2 gigabyte ones. They're getting expensive because they're old. But you can format that as a 2 gigabyte card. So that's what we do. We just format it smaller. Go ahead. There's a library provided by Microchip that does the access for this SD card that makes this fairly easy. So the one drawback here is that the file allocation table where the directory is stored, you need to read that every time you want to start a file. And every time you cross one of those cluster boundaries, you have to go back out and read the directory. And between that reading of those sectors for the directory and the 3 different tracks, which and then could be 3 different sectors in the directory if you get your files far enough apart, that's just way too much overhead to handle in what I was doing. So what I did is if you start from scratch and you format a card, and some of this was done by reverse engineering, but the files are all put sequentially on there on the micro SD card. So in reality, all you need to know is where the start is and how long it is. And as long as you don't have bad sectors, it's all going to work. So
you just barrel ahead to the next file?
Absolutely. No, not to the next file, but to the next sector, yeah, or they're actually in 512 byte sectors in the micro SD card. And so by the way we lay them out on there, we know that they're all sequential, and so we can just barrel through and read through them, like you said. Now you could do this with a special writer, and you could write the files on. Being able to write them through a PC is just a really huge advantage. So basically what you do is you format the card every time you start to make sure that you don't get deleted files in there. And actually, this was unique enough that they accepted it as an article in CircuitCeller. So there's an October 2012, you can go read about this algorithm that I put together. The last thing here, for audio components, a lot of the things we did on Wonelli was trying to figure out what parts would work best and how we can get something that's reasonably priced and does what we need. And so you're always torn between, well, do I build something custom or do I just go buy something? And almost always you can buy something cheaper. I guess that's what I'm saying here. The other thing you've got is if your ATX power supply, for example, goes out, you're not really tied to the one we used. You could just go replace it with a standard one. It's a standard part. So I think from that point of view, it's easy to replace those. So I'm using this Rosewill RD400-2B, is one I picked at the time. It was reasonably priced. It also had an advantage that when I tore into it, I found out I could lift a leg on an IC in there and disable the overcurrent protection. When we first started, we were using a really big audio amp, and that audio amp, you could actually get it loud enough that it would trip the supply on really loud music passages. And we're using a different one now. This Boss Audio R102 is what we're using. It's a 200 watt amplifier. It's about $30. You can buy it on Amazon. And with that one, we don't have the problem. The power supply is hefty enough that it doesn't overcurrent. We're also using these standard TSG 1644R speakers. So again, they're 6.5-inch speakers. I would say they're not the best speakers in the world, but they're really pretty good for the price. Next section is the Solar City that I did. So this was prototype number 2, and I don't have a lot on this, so I'll just go through it really quickly. This was a full conversion of a game. So after we did the Black Hole Junior, it was, well, yeah, that was cute, but can you do a real game? And to be honest, the Black Hole Junior was almost a real game. It had almost everything in it. So this was a pretty easy conversion to expand it. So we did an exact implementation of the game rules. One exception was that in an EM, when you hit multiple drop targets, because of the way the scoring works, it just can't score them. And so we had a discussion on this. I remember having a discussion with Dennis as to, well, what should happen? And the vote was that it should score them. So we could have done it either way. We happened to score multiple targets. The game plays a little faster because it's 27 volt DC versus the AC that's in the game to start with. And we added some attract mode lighting. And later I put in a little bit of sound in a couple weird cases, like when extra ball is enabled, it does some sounds. So we ran this in the WhizBang booth at Midwest Gaming Classic. It was also out on the main play floor at Midwest Gaming Classic for 2 years. Probably shouldn't say this, but actually won the best EM award there 2 years. It's not, I guess I didn't feel too bad because technically it still is an EM in its heart. But I guess the point of all this is these shows turned out to be a really good place if you want to test something, because I just remember the first time we had Wonelli out there when the kid came up and pushed the start button 5 times and started a 5-player game. It's like, who would think to do that? The game went off in the weeds because it never tested that. This is a picture of the underside of the playfield of how things fit together on the Solar City. So again, it's finding a place for the boards and then wiring things up. Go ahead, Jake. And this is the back box. There are 3 boards in the back box of that. One board drove the 4 score reels for player 1. One drove the 4 score reels for player 2. They shared the lights, and there were some switch inputs. But and the board at the bottom is actually the master board then, too, that runs the whole game. Now, I'm going to move We still have a little bit of time? 5 minutes? Okay, we're going to have to go quick here. So we've just got a couple quick charts here on the Wonelli construction. This is the three finished Wonelli solid-state games. And this was a picture of how I went about wiring the playfield on these. So I just took a picture of the underside of the playfield and then started sketching on it to say, how do you group things together to get the minimal number of wires to our board? So I'd say, okay, well, these four lamps go together and these four switches go together. So they're done in little groups of four that we wired to the boards. Next. And then we started putting the boards down, trying to figure out where they fit given that where the groups are next. And then it's routing the power. Again, the power just hooks to all the boards in parallel, and the Cat5 cables daisy chain through. And then it's just starting to connect up the groups that were seen on the previous page. More wiring, and there's what the playfield looked like when we're all done. So although we did cut out a lot of wiring going down to the main connector between the cabinet and the back box, there still is a lot of wiring, and it takes a while to wire up a playfield. Go ahead, Jake. The back box, similarly, took the back of the back glass and defined the groups that we want. And here, they weren't individually controllable, so we had large groups. There was like 15 in one group, 12 in another. Go ahead, Jacob. So that gets me to this point here. That Wonelli had a lot more lamps than a standard EM game. And if you go look at it out there, even the Stern version, it still does. There's 136 controlled LEDs on that game. And because of the grouping, it's really 75 controlled elements, if you will. So some of them turn on like a group of 10, but there's 75 controlled lamps, if you will. So one of the reasons this is solid-state games really don't have as many lamps because things like match lamps and ball in play are done on their regular display, so you don't have dedicated lamps for those. The last point here is that 6.3 volts is a terrible choice. It just didn't work well for us. So we had 5 volts and we had 12 volts. So without putting in a special supply for the LEDs, we ran the lamps on 12 volts, which isn't the end of the world, but it means you're just burning up a lot more heat than you'd like to. So one thing, if you're looking into doing any of this yourself, these small LED boards, they have CoinTaker has them for the spike system. These are really great. So they have only a 37 ohm dropping resistor on them. So you can take those and put those in and run them right off of 5 volts. I'll wrap up here with the results. We haven't had any issues with the solid-state Wonelli games. CAN bus, it's been a perfect fit for this. There's only been minor extensions even with later things I did with the bus. Solar City now has an Aztec and a 9-ball playfield I plug into that. It's a Franken game. We did create a Belly Kiss soundtrack or a sound kit so we could tie into the old 1979 Belly Kiss and add some background sounds and callouts. And the controller board has been enhanced. The one I'm sending around there actually is an enhanced version, but it's still upward compatible. And this is the end of a weekend build that we did out at Dennis's. So we had a couple weeks where we had a good time out there building games. And wrap it up here. Obviously, thanks to Greg and Dennis. They put a lot of faith in me for even being able to do this. Mark Wayna was a great help when we were building these things. He's a terrific tech. Ken Walker, Chris Graner, and there were a bunch of people that were involved in this, and we all had a good time. So yeah, if anybody wants to catch up with me later or seems to be around, I can talk a little bit about what I did to the next version of that controller board. But I think we're out of time right now.